Okay. Moggy, you got a comment to make? Thank you, Mo.
Well, yes, Howard said it, really. It was just a little note I made when Warwick was talking. That there's always going to be people who are not necessarily elected in or anything, but there are people who have this sort of take charge personality who will always sort of leap in and get up and take charge and assume everybody else is going to go along with that. And to a certain extent, a lot of people do. So it's not a case of, really how things are structured. I think you're always going to have these sort of people that will, just seize an opportunity. So I've sort of lost the thread now, so I can't say anything more.
Next one then is Carla. Thank you, Carla.
It was Paddy. Right, the reason I like Bookchin is because he is so, he's easy for the layman or woman to understand. I mean, we all understand hierarchies rather than the complicated, rather than Marxism, which is much more complicated and to read and to understand. And I understand, hierarchies existed before capitalism. And there is the suspicion that just because you have a propertyless society and moneyless society doesn't necessarily mean that you have no hierarchy. I'm now talking on from the point of view of, say, the hierarchy of men over women, or women over children, or men or parents over children. So I'm not sure that will necessarily disappear, well, at least initially. But as I say, back to Bookchin, we do understand about hierarchies, and I think that's something that perhaps our party could emphasise more, rather than the kind of, the whole sort of banking and economics and all that blah, 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 that a lot of us kind of leaves us a bit sort of, not really understanding. But we do understand about her. We do understand about people, a group of people, rather, that have power over another group of people. So that's what I take from Bookchin. He makes it very, 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 very accessible, the knowledge. Anyway, and thanks, Nick, for a great talk.
Well, thanks, Carla. I totally agree with what you said. I mean, I think you've summed up Bookchin's principal ideas quite succinctly and very well. Thanks.
Right. Nick has got another link there, but it's Listen Anarchist instead of Listen Marxist.
Yes, it was a response to Adams. So, but Adams, actually, it's not quite the same response, but Adams put a link in to the one he was talking about that's in the Socialist Standard. I think it'll probably be very similar arguments, actually. I'll need to read both.
Okay. Right. And next is John.
On the question of hierarchies, it's certainly true, as we know, that hierarchies have pre-existed capitalist society. But I think within capitalism itself, there's large sections of the population for whom hierarchies are just unacceptable. And even in workplaces where you have people who know what they have to do, in the role that they're performing, they just ignore the hierarchy. The hierarchy might think that it knows things, but certainly in my workplace, we all know that it's a waste of time asking them or bringing them into anything. So we tend to only involve them if we need more money for the task at hand. And there's a ridiculous rigmarole has to be done to achieve that. And much of the hierarchy in capitalism is about control. And in a socialist society with common ownership and democratic control, it's very difficult to see practically how any hierarchy could either if it existed, try to sustain itself. And I think, as I say, I think by the time we established socialism, the notion of hierarchies being something that we would give some kind of respect to would just be laughed out of court. It would just be sniggered at by people. So I think that the job of getting rid of the idea of hierarchies, the ideology behind it, would largely have been achieved by the time we achieved socialism.
You want to come back on that, Nick?
No, I don't think so. Move on to the item, I think.
Next, we have Mark. Mark Zed. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, this has been really good. And thanks again, Nick. And I thought Carla's sort of summary of the hierarchy question was really good. I do think that, you know, there is a slight danger of being a bit complacent as to the potential for the creeping back in of hierarchy or even the sustenance of some kind of hierarchy. I mean, I think we have to acknowledge that hierarchy did appear in human society out of an admittedly primitive egalitarianism. And, you know, any future socialist society may well face challenges, even of an objective character, perhaps relating to resources available due to planetary degeneration, that might lead to certain pressures that could sort of encourage the reemergence of hierarchy. So sometimes I wonder whether we won't have to be sort of, as it were, permanently on the alert for those kinds of issues, rather than thinking that we kind of make it over the line and then we can sort of, as it were, rest and it will all just take care of itself because we got rid of the system of hierarchy in which we live, namely capitalism. I'd like to come back to Nick on the question of when I asked about the political question of the organizational question, because obviously if Bookchin classified himself as an anarchist, then presumably he would have, am I right in saying that he would have perhaps criticized, if he was alive today or if we could talk to him, we could have talked to him when he was alive, about the policy of the SPGB. Would he have taken an anarchist line on rejecting the direct political struggle, in the sense that we believe that we would need to gain a majority that would be expressed in an election? Would he have objected to using, you know, parliamentary elections in the way that we do? So, I mean, in other words, would our criticism of him be the same criticism that we would have of anarchist forms of organization, which seem to be perhaps focusing just on, maybe focusing too much on creating small communities and not trying to get involved in the whole political struggle on a bigger scale? I wonder if you have any comment on that, Nick.
Oh, that's quite a difficult. The problem with anarchism, as the way I see it, is kind of it's a bit of an incoherent ideology, really. I mean, you know, Bookchin, he had this idea of a kind of anarchist spectrum. So you'd, you know, on the right, you'd go as far as people just anti-state, you know, Max Stirner, even Margaret Thatcher would perhaps sit there. And then you had all of these other kind of primitivist, mystic kind of people like Hakim Bey and John Zerzan. And then across on the left, moving toward a more socialist side, you know, there's a kind of spectrum of different anarchists, you know, the syndicalists, you know, and then the anarcho-communists, which are further to the left. He was attacked on many sides in the 60s, and that's when he kind of effectively denounced his anarchism, because he felt it had been taken over by by the right, effectively, you know, by the libertarian right, and these mystical people like Zerzan, etc. I think he, so far, what I've read and what I understand about the party, there doesn't seem a great divergence in the way Bookchin felt about, you know, how he'd, you know, the implement, my brain's gone, socialism, sorry, implement socialism through. He saw it as a long-term process, and he saw it as evolutionary in the same that we do. I think he was certainly came against this idea of supporting or trying to modify capitalism through the election system by, you know, supporting parties that were less capitalist than others. In the same way that I understand that the SPGB do, he did say that he felt that representation, standing for elections, was probably not effective. But I don't think he was vehemently against that, as far as I'm aware.
Thanks, Nick. Next is Howard again. Hello, Howard.
Thanks, Brian. I think it was a good idea, Nick, to show those little videos of Bookchin himself. You know, you saw what he was like as a human being. Obviously, an inspiring figure. The way he talked, even the way he talked about the way the verb to buy has come to be used in modern society. I don't buy that. Very good. Very impressed by that kind of thing, I must say. The video, the Mad Blender video that we saw at the end, I'd actually seen it before, but very good. Just to say that if anybody wants to watch other Mad videos from Mad Blender, they are very good indeed. Her sort of message at the end of the difference between Marxism and Bookchinism, as it were, didn't mean a lot to me. They didn't seem very different at all. She seemed to be saying that the systems of domination and hierarchy had existed throughout history, and the modern manifestation, yes, was in capitalism. But somehow she seemed to be saying that socialists, people such as the Socialist Party, didn't recognise this. We do. We do recognise that systems of hierarchy and servitude existed before. It's just that currently that particular system of hierarchy and servitude is capitalism, and therefore that's what we've got to overcome. So didn't see, I must say, one or two other people have mentioned, didn't see a great deal of difference.
Thank you, Howard. Next. Thank you, Paul.
Okay, cheers. Thanks. Good on you, Nick. That really was an absolutely outstanding presentation. It really was. I'm more here to just sort of comment more on that. I thought it was really well put together, and you know, it certainly whet my appetite. I don't really know a right lot or next to nothing about Bookchin. Obviously heard his name, read a little bit about him, the Standard and such like, but it certainly whet my appetite to learn a little bit more about him. That's certainly given us a start. I can be quite narrow-minded or sort of tunnel vision sometimes if it's, you know, not got Marx or Engels or, you know, in front of it somewhere. I tend to dismiss it, you know. Enjoy that. Who was it? William Morris. William Morris is another one of my interests, but certainly Bookchin has never really featured before, and I'll certainly try and find out a bit more about it. I mean, I could sit through that again sometime, maybe on a Sunday night Central Branch meeting if other comrades are up for it. But as far as the presentation, I was maybe one of the lucky ones that I didn't have any technical issues at all. I seen, you know, all there was to see, and my sound and everything was perfect too. So, you know, just basically just to give you a bit of a pat on the back and say well done for putting that together. I personally, I thought it was excellent, and I think they deserve a wee bit of praise for that. So thanks, Nick. Cheers.
Well, thanks a lot, Paul. Was that a friendly reminder about the central meeting?
Well, maybe. See you on Sunday.
Right.
Cheers.
Next, Dougie McCann. Thank you, Doug.
Yeah. It's very interesting about hierarchies and society. I mean, one of the problems we've got is nationalism, and another problem is religion. And it can lead to genocide, like you've got with Rohingya Muslims and Buddhists being taught to hate Muslims in the world, and they had to flee into Bangladesh, and they killed people and raped women and things. So that's the kind of thing we're up against, really, you know, nationalism and religion that breeds hatred between human beings and things like that in the world. And it's happened throughout history, you know, with Nazi Germany against the Jews and against people who were communist or gay or gypsies or whatever. So it goes on, right? You know, so we've got to try and put it to people that we're all human beings. And as Murray Bookchin would say, we can live in a democratic society where we all care for each other and we don't have this madness of capitalism and what it creates in the world. But I enjoyed the presentation. Thanks very much.
Steve next. Steve.
Hi, yeah, okay, thanks. Just a couple of quick points. But by the way, Mark, I'm not complacent at all about what socialism will be like. Obviously, there'll be social problems within there. But my question would be is, what would be the economic basis for any sort of hierarchy? Can't see when we've got this. When we've got this means of production held and distribution held in common, that's one thing. But the other thing that I wanted to raise is that, I mean, there's some quite interesting the film that one of the films that Nick showed us a clip from, I think, Forms of Freedom. I'm not sure. You have to correct me. But Butch Kitten does make a lot of good points about the way that we live in an atomized society under capitalism, and that's probably even got even worse than when he was alive. But there are a lot of differences. Let's not think that we've no differences with. Because he's actually at the end of the Forms of Freedom speech that he gave, he was in favour of the Sandinistas, and he's one of these that was promoting arguing that we should support national liberation, which is certainly something that the party would never ever go along with. Just wonder when you've got a view on that then, Nick.
I don't think there's any evidence that Butchin supported any nationalistic movement. He was completely against that. I haven't studied the relationship, well, his issues against the Sandinistas. I know, so I can't really come back on that. I haven't studied that myself, so I'll endeavour to look that up and maybe respond in due course. Okay,
thanks Nick. Cheers.
Norman, could you please mute your mic? Thank you. Right, next is Paddy. Thank you, Paddy.
Yeah, just on this business of hierarchy, I think we sort of tend to, on the whole, just assume, you know, amongst ourselves that hierarchies are bad things and we don't like them. You know, we resent them at an emotional level because, you know, socialists have all got kind of authority issues and that's fine. But actually, I think we probably don't make enough of the case against hierarchies. And just to give an example, quite a few years ago, I read a document by a business consultancy that was looking at, it gave some case studies of what was wrong with some quite big businesses that were failing or, you know, not functioning very well. And they identified the problem with a lot of these big companies as being their hierarchies. They had overly elaborate hierarchies. And some of the, it was really kind of illuminating what they said about hierarchies in these companies. I mean, I can't remember everything they said, but I can remember some things. And some things they pointed to were the fact that communications in hierarchy, if you imagine a big company and you've got different departments, so you've got different strands of the hierarchy, a bit like an upside down tree. So what you've got, first of all, is you've got a long way, you've got a long way for information to travel from the bottom of one particular branch all the way back up to the top. And so you've got a problem of sort of Chinese whispers, information being subtly distorted by either on purpose or by accident, so that you end up with the apex being out of touch with what's really going on at the base. Add to that, you've also got problems of broken links, which they identify as basically sort of incompetent elements within the hierarchy who prevent information flow from going up the chain or going back down the chain. Furthermore, because of the way that the departments worked, it was impossible or very nearly impossible for to see any sideways information transference, so horizontal information transference. So, for example, if you had an idea, you know, say you were bottom of the tree in one department, you had a great idea for something that would help the people at the bottom of a tree in another department, you couldn't go straight to them, in other words, horizontally. You had to put send your idea all the way up the chain, and then it would have to come all the way back down a different chain before it reached that department, because you couldn't go sideways. So that was another thing. Then there was the lack of initiative by people in the hierarchy who are basically, because of the way the hierarchy works, their motivation, their principal motivation is to defend their position. So you get the problem of Jobsworths who only care about their position, which is understandable because that's how hierarchies are. It's all about power. And defending your position in the hierarchy becomes much more important than actually doing a decent job. The sum total of all of this creates a sclerotic structure which is incapable of adaptation. It's not able to move, it's not able to change, because all the elements in it are only concerned with keeping still and keeping their status. And on top of all of that, and this is something I didn't get from this business consultancy because they wouldn't care about it, but certainly socialists know about this, is the lack of motivation and the stress caused by your relative lack of status within hierarchies. Now, Michael Marmot has done quite a lot of work on this in books like The Health Gap, where he shows that in a famous Whitehall study, he showed that the worst life expectancy was found in the people who were on the doors in Whitehall, because the sort of levels of the ranks tended to go up with the floors in the building. In other words, the higher up the floors you went, the higher the rank you got to. He found that life expectancy increased from the door level every time you went up the stairs. And the more stairs you went up, the more your life expectancy increased. And weirdly, the same thing's been found in chimpanzees. Work by Jane Goodall and others has shown that low-status chimps suffer from overloads of cortisol stress hormone, and tend to have worse health outcomes and shorter lifespans than high status chimps. So it isn't just a human thing. This is actually a biochemical thing as well. So all in all, I'm just pointing out that we don't make enough of the actual scientific case against hierarchy. It's not simply that it's something we all hate because we've all got a chip on our shoulder. There's actually a really strong, solid evidence-based case against hierarchies, which of course capitalism can never accommodate because capitalism is all about power. But I sometimes think we miss a trick when we forget this sort of stuff. Okay, that's me.
Okay, next we have Janet Carter. Thank you, Janet.
Yeah, thank you for this. I really found the whole production stimulating and extremely interesting, and I would like to see it again and hear more discussion on it. But and I did think he and the video at the end really portrayed totally the problems within the society. And all the horrific things that are happening. But I found myself thinking, yes, but, several times through. And then at the end, the very end, I thought, I think I must have missed something because I don't see any suggested solutions to this. Okay, get rid of hierarchies, but I think, as Paddy's just said, you don't do that within capitalism. You can't do that within capitalism. So you can't get rid of hierarchies. Then, and you haven't got rid of the ownership of land or production for profit, which seemed to me wasn't being meant. He did talk about it, but not to say you can't have it anymore. I don't know how you can dot the I's and cross the T's at the very end. And I do think that as we advocate, the parliamentary system is a way of showing how the people are feeling towards a closer time towards socialism, how the idea is spreading and growing. Because until that time comes, you can't take over, you can't deal with any big problem because you really don't have the legal right. The whole system of the capitalist society based on some sort of legality, and you could easily be accused of wrongful actions if you didn't have some legal basis. And the legal basis within capitalism is the fact that enough of a majority have voted for a change in society, and until that happens or is seen to be going to happen, you're on very uncomfortable ground. And, you know, that people say, yes, but the army would always come out against you. The ruling class could always call out the army. But I'm thinking of a time when the idea has spread so thoroughly through society that though people may still be getting their wages from the army or from some coercive force, they're actually there mentally thinking very differently. And so it wouldn't take a few seconds or a few discussions or rallies to actually change them and tip them over to accepting the ideas of socialism. And I don't know, and I may have missed it, but I don't, I mean, it does seem to me that Marx is very clever, and I found his ideas hard to grapple. Surplus value and that the working class doesn't pay tax and things like that, very hard to grasp. But it does put the kibosh of any arguments against. Once you've got hold of that idea of surplus value, you know where the value is coming from, where the profit is coming from, and who is getting the most out of that profit. And then I think once you've grasped that idea, it doesn't matter where you are in the present day hierarchy. You know that you stand to be in a better position if you can only do away with that that top. Top level of the ownership of society. I hear a lot on Farming Today. It comes on at about 6 o'clock in the morning, and it's very, very interesting because it's coming up with all different ideas that the farmers have for growing their crops. And there's one herb I've heard recently up in the Peak District, I think, that is talking about putting his sheep to graze. He sows a field of oats or wheat, and then he puts his sheep to graze, and they chew that down through the winter, so they get the benefit of that plant. They go off to graze something else or eat grass, and the plants grow again, because they will do that, can do that. And the sheep have also fertilized the soil, and to a certain extent they've loosened it as well. And the whole system is nicely round, it's sensible. And there's an awful lot of other ideas that are coming forward in farming. It seems to me in small scale farming, because I don't know that it's profitable for large scale farming. And those are not pulled together. Those ideas don't seem to be pulled together. But it is on that sort of basis. We're doing it for ourselves and doing it for the benefit of us all. And the other thing I wanted to speak about communities, because I realise that in capitalism we are losing all the communities we have, but I'm not all that happy about the communities we had. I think they were terribly hierarchical, and they may have had a basis of friendship and comradeship and relationship within them. Sure, some areas did. But also there was the person who did the organising and got looked up to, and had a statue built to them at the end. I think that that community business is a bit of a slightly suspect one within capitalism, and I do think that the feeling that we have of a society in which we are all equal, we do all help according to our needs, contribute according to our abilities, can't be bettered, and can't have a hierarchy. You might well revere somebody who's very good at something technical, like flying an aeroplane or doing brain surgery, but that doesn't mean to say that they can go out and get their loaf of bread or their bottle of wine without in capitalism paying for it, whereas in socialism we would decide what we want to produce, how we want to produce it, and then it would be freely available from whatever resources that may still be available after all the degradation that's gone on. I'll stop now.
Thank you, Janet. Right, next is Carla. Thank you, Carla.
Oh, hi, yeah. Hopefully at the risk of not repeating myself, and in response to Steve, just because, you know, he said we don't think there'll be hierarchy of any kind in a socialist society. Well, hopefully not. But however, as Paddy also pointed out, it's not necessarily about economics. You know, sometimes it's about status. It's about power. And people can have power over others, and a group of people can have power over others without there being anything to do with money, or it's about power and it's about status, and hopefully that wouldn't happen. But you know, there's a lot of psychological stuff that goes on, and I don't think it's as simple as saying that if you take away the basis of, say, you know, if I'm economically dependent on someone else, then I kind of have to do what they say. I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. Anyway, just a small point.
Thank you, Carla. Let's have Adam. Adam.
Yeah, I just wanted to come back on something. Murray Butchkin as a speaker. I actually heard him when he came to London, and he is an impressive speaker. In fact, he's a bit like Tony Cliff. I don't know whether that's a compliment or an insult. But on the other hand, he wasn't a good writer. I try the ecology of freedom, and I suppose that, I mean, it should have been edited or sub-edited by people. That last film that was shown by that, you know, Mad Glenda, explained something which why he brings in Hegel is that, you know, he's trying to develop a new theory. What it was mentioned, wasn't it? It was dialectical naturalism. I mean, it doesn't. I don't think it's very good at all. It's certainly not his best writing. But as I say, I suspect that he might have been a sort of dominant figure in the social ecology movement. Nobody dared to say to him, "Look, this thing needs editing." But on the question of whether or not he's a anarchist. I mean, for a period of time, but as Nick has pointed out, at a certain point he got fed up with it. And it wasn't just with primitivists like Zerzan, it was with lifestyle anarchists as well. And he, in fact, before he became an anarchist, and in fact when he was still writing for a Trotskyist newspaper, I think his best writing is called Towards a Liberatory Technology. In other words, he wasn't a primitive. He didn't want to go back to small scale. He wanted modern technology to be applied in a ecological way. And I think that's why he would split for some of these primitivists and people to go back to small scale agriculture. But another reason why he was that I think somebody mentioned it. I think Dick mentioned it. Towards the end, he wasn't opposed on principle to contesting elections. He was in favor of contesting local elections. And the social ecologists did put up some candidates in Vermont. One time in the past, I took the trouble to find out it was about the same as we get, you know, 1 or 2%. So we're in the same boat there. But I think he can be said to be a socialist or a communist, as he would call himself. He does really stand for common ownership and for a society without a state, without classes, and also money. So I don't think he can be challenged on that ground. I mean, let's say what I like about it, he isn't dogmatically anti-election like his former colleagues in the anarchist movement are. Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Adam. Next, we've got Kevin.
Hi there. So just going back a wee bit to maybe slightly tangentially, there was a wee bit of discussion there about Murray Bookchin supposedly providing, you know, support for the Sandinistan movement. And I'm sort of interested in that where you have large groups of oppressed people such as the Kurds, who the Kurdish movement seeks to form their own country. Now, obviously, you could say that, yes, that's nationalism. But at the same time, surely some forms of nationalism can be good, in that groups of people are able to secede from their states to begin new societies. Yes, they have to initially operate under the current world structures, because overnight socialism isn't going to unravel hierarchy and capitalism immediately. But if you have groups of peoples who wish to create nation states that lean towards socialism or anarchism, equitable societies, but also reach out to other states that want to follow the same principles. I mean, is that considered verboten nationalism? That's the end of my question.
Yes.
So you're suggesting then that the Kurds shouldn't be permitted to form their own nation state throughout the areas they occupy in northern Iran, Iraq, and Turkey. Yet their society may be far more equitable than that they create, may be far more equitable than the current oppressive states that they are spread across. That seems to sort of damn them forever, you know. Fine, okay, I'll leave it at that.
All right, thank you, Kevin. Next, we got Mike Brown.
Thank you, Mark, for a very interesting discussion. I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, but first a few comments on this. The member talking about hierarchy at work. The last job I had was an admin in the social services for admin and for adults and children. But there was a minimum amount of hierarchy in there. There were social workers, there were managers, there was deputy high-level managers, and there was the manager, because they all had legal responsibilities. There's no sort of fashion that sort of hierarchy. I could see why they were having it. You know, it wasn't a factory or the way John Cummings was talking about. It was a very definite, clear legal line, and it was needed because of they were dealing with adults and children who really needed help. So we need to be careful about just dismissing everything hierarchical. The other thing is, Peter Kropotkin used to write about anarchism 100 years before Murray Buchan did. I'm just wondering, Nick, did you know too much about the difference between the two of them? One came from an agricultural background, and Buchan seemed to be living in the city all his life. So it would be slightly different. And in the 1982 book about hierarchies, what sources had he, because that's 40 years ago, what sources had he for the information about the pre-literal societies? I've never seen any of these books. They're not in the party library, they're not in the local library. I don't want to have to buy the damn things. I'd like to know what sources he was relying on, because we've learned a hell of a lot about pre-literal societies and the origins of class society. That's not capital class, but class society. People ruling other over others. And I don't think the way it comes over in the summaries, it looked like a bit out of date. Are you able to give me any answers to those two questions?
Hi, is that Mike speaking?
Yep.
The quality was, the sound quality was really, really bad. I couldn't catch a lot of that. If you could send me a message or...
Now, can I say it again? Because I'm quite dyslexic. I don't like my typing.
Oh, okay.
Then. I can't spell very well.
Okay.
But, right, in the Law of Freedom, the 1982 book, he talks about pre-literal societies, and how the origins of domination came about. I'm just wondering, what sources was he using then? It would be in the index or the bibliography, because we've learned a lot of difference from, you know, what they used to know in the 50s, in the last 40 years. The other thing was The Conquest of Bread. You ever hear of that book by a Russian anarchist?
But it's in French, unfortunately. But yeah, that's the Kropotkin book.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you read Mutual Aid and stuff like that, it does seem very similar to what Murray Buchan was talking about. But one came from, you know, an agricultural peasant background, and one, Murray Buchan, came from the 50s in the cities. So I'm just wondering what the difference much was.
Well, on the first question about his origins that he's using for hierarchy, I mean, it's quite a big question. I'm actually reading Remaking Society, and in that he quotes a number of anthropologists. So I would need to come back and check on that. You said it was a book that was published in 1982. What's the title of that one? Laws of...
Hold on. Let's switch to the... The Ecology of Freedom, The Emergence and Dissolution of Hierarchy, 1982, that one.
Okay. Well, he's actually reprinted that in 2005. That's a copy I've got. So I will look through that. I haven't finished reading it. I'm only halfway through, actually. So I'll check that out, and perhaps I can come back to you on that. Point you to the sources that are used.
Yeah, I'd be quite interested in that because they might be out of date by now. And I never read The Origin of the Family and all that from English because it's too old. And it was relying too much on, you know, sort of anecdotal stuff rather than scientific.
Okay.
Thank you, Mike. Okay, John next. John coming next. Thank you, John.
Yes, just on the subject of nationalism that was raised, it may well be that some newly created nation might operate slightly better than some other, but that's really beside the point. It's not something that socialists could advocate, is that this group of people should be allowed to break away from that other nation and form their own nation. It's not any part of our case. And it's something that we may be about to find out quite soon, that another small country is likely to break away from a larger one that has been joined with for 300 years. And although it's perfectly viable as an entity, why do it? It's just, it's the last thing the world needs is more nation states waving their stupid little flags and singing their silly little songs. You know, we don't need that kind of thing. What we need is for more people to organise in a practical way to bring about a real change, a change towards socialism, not to go backwards into the early days of capitalist development in Europe, where nation states might have been seen to be, in broad sweep of historical terms, a step forward, but it did nothing for the working class within those states.
Thank you, John. Paddy next.
Yeah, sorry, me again. Yeah, I just wanted to go support what Carla said a bit ago, because Carla was saying, you know, hierarchies aren't always about money. And when she was saying that, one or two things sort of popped into my head. First of all, I think that in socialism, I think we have to accept that there would be influential people. You know, there would be certain people who wouldn't be very influential and certain people who would be. You know, you've got certain people who are very sort of plugged in, network, very networky people. You know, they know a lot of people. You know, these are the sort of people who are influencers, which is fine because, you know, they hear a lot of opinions as well. So that's fine, too. And you'd see that sort of thing in socialism as well. You know, not everyone's the same. Some people are very good at networking. Other people aren't. You know, that's fine. You wouldn't want it any other way particularly. But it struck me that science is a good example of where influence can really wield significant amounts of power without money actually being directly involved. And I'll give you two examples of this. So a lot of you will have probably heard of, or at least or read even, Ben Goldacre, who's written a number of books. One of his well-known ones is called Bad Science, in which he inveighs quite heavily against what he calls eminence-based medicine. This is as opposed to evidence-based medicine. This is the idea that, what you do is you listen to the most eminent people in the field, and whatever they say must be right. That's not a scientific principle at all. You know, that's a departure from science, which is, you know, Goldacre's whole point. Somebody else, whose name escapes me now, made a similar point that because of this problem of eminence in science, you cannot get past these people. They are the top of their professions. What they say goes. Heretical ideas just don't get a look in. And you basically have to wait until those people die before anything can change. And this guy, whose name I forget, came up with a great little axiom: science advances with each funeral. Another person who said similar things is a guy called Lee Smolin. He's a physicist at the Perimeter Institute in Ontario, I think it is in Canada. He wrote a really good book called The Problem with Physics. Very readable. You don't need to be a scientist or anything to read this. It's very readable. And he's talking about his own particular field is a thing called quantum gravity. And what he does is he rails about the fact that quantum gravity gets almost no investment, no research. Hardly any papers are written on it. Hardly anyone's working in it. He thinks it's the best thing since sliced bread. He thinks it's the thing that's going to tie up all of the problems that physics has got and create the grand unifying theory. But nobody's working in it. Why not? Because they're all working in string theory, which Lee Smolin reckons is a complete waste of time and it is a complete cul-de-sac. But the point of the book is, why is everyone working in string theory? It's this eminence thing again. String theory is so dominant because all the eminent professors are string theorists, and they've got a stranglehold on physics research because they do all the hiring and firing, but also they do all the peer reviewing for new articles. So whenever they get an article, you know, in quantum gravity or something else that's heretical, they just slag it off. So they control the research, the direction of research in physics. This is his argument. I'm not saying he's right, but that's what he says. And these are just a couple of examples, Ben Goldacre and Lee Smolin, where science is being sort of, it's being held by the throat by this culture of eminence within it. I'm not saying that that socialism would have this problem, but I think it's something that we need to think about. We don't want to just leap to a very easy conclusion that once you've taken property society away, once you've taken the market away, that's the end of the problem. That was what Carla was saying, and I think that deserves more exploration as well.
Could I just say something else about that? I take it you can hear me okay. There is a scientist, an Italian astrophysicist or cosmologist called Carlo Rovelli, and he's been getting some attention lately. He's proposing a theory called loop quantum gravity. Whether or not string theory will give way to that, I don't know. String theory is certainly, you know, quite dominant. There's even a cosmologist called Freeman Dyson, one of the older guys. He says it's a waste of time trying to merge, you know, quantum theory with general relativity. And he thinks that, you know, it's an exercise in futility. But anyway, so much for that. But I think that, you know, these attitudes where people like to be dominant will persist for some time, you know, in a socialist society. The state itself. It's always been the argument of the Socialist Party that the state, you know, won't disappear overnight. It will, the words are, to it will wither away and die. And I think this will probably be the case with attitudes, you know, hierarchical attitudes. Perhaps it will take a couple of generations, maybe several generations, you know, before that's, you know, relegated to the dustbin of history. Capitalism, you know, any society, you know, is so powerful in shaping a person's attitude, you know, their mindset. And I'm sure it'll take some time, you know, before these unhealthy, unwholesome attitudes, which are products of a property society, will finally, you know, disappear. And human beings, you know, will have a healthier disposition towards each other, this desire to dominate, this craving for one-upmanship, you know, will, you know, go out the window.
Thank you for that. Well, looking at the time now, it's 32 minutes past nine. Right. I think we can draw this conversation to a close, but before we do, I think I've been dying and again in my little bit, because hierarchy has been a concern of myself, done a little bit of studying on it, and it appears to me that Putin seems to forget by his advocacy of participatory and erect democracy, what he's suggesting is a structure that would eliminate hierarchy. Because what that such a structure does is produce leaders, right? In that it's a delegated structure. Like the leaders that we have in a hierarchy, these are leaders in a class of society. And consequently, you could describe them as leaders with a small L. In other words, they put themselves forward as equals. Thank you. And with that, comrades, I bring the meeting to a close and thank everybody for attending. And very good presentation, Nick.
Thanks a lot.
May you do one again.
Great. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks, Nick.
Thanks, Nick.
Night. Good night.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. That was great.
Thanks. Thank you.